Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was a time when war for Israel meant facing Egypt and Jordan and worrying about Saudi Arabia beyond, but not this time, not yet anyway. In the face of kidnappings and Hezbollah rockets, Israeli warplanes have pounded Lebanon for the last week, and the audience for these attacks sits in Syria and Iran. In the Tehran-Damascus axis of evil, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said yesterday. So, Hezbollah and Israel have both taken the conflict up a notch, maybe a big one, maybe big enough to shake moderate regimes and bring on a regional deathmatch. Some in Israel and Iran may want just that. Up next on Point, the eruption in the Middle East and where it ends. Joining me first today from Beirut is Babak Daganpache. He's Middle East correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Babak, thanks for being with us. What are you seeing and hearing? What's the latest there?
Well, there's been attacks across Beirut earlier this morning. There have also been strikes in the Bekaa Valley just east of Beirut. So, as you mentioned, the missiles are still flying, and this conflict just does seem to be escalating every day.
Is there any sign of a change in Hezbollah's posture? Is there a sign that the Israeli pressure is taking a toll?
No, not at all. Hassan Nasrallah's rhetoric has been very tough, and no sign at all of giving any quarter, of laying down arms, of negotiations, really.
What's the impact on civilians at this point? Can you summarize it?
The impact has been pretty dramatic. There are thousands of people who are leaving the south, particularly from the city of Tyr, and also further north to the city of Sidon. Just this afternoon, we were on some of the roads that those refugees are using, and there are just hundreds of families coming through with cars, and they have white strips of cloth attached to the cars to indicate they're civilians. And, they're all heading toward safer ground, basically, to Beirut or maybe even further north.
What about the evacuation of foreign nationals, of Americans? We've heard of U.S. Marines headed to help take out U.S. citizens.
I was just at the port of Beirut a couple of minutes ago, actually, where the U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Feltman showed up to say goodbye to some of those American citizens. Approximately 300 Americans are leaving on a large transport boat that does include people from other countries, other nationalities. And among those were about 100 students from the American University of Beirut who really have been stuck on their campus since day one of the conflict.
An Israeli official has said that Israel has perhaps degraded or taken out about 30% of Hezbollah rockets in Lebanon. Does that sound realistic, reasonable to you?
It's impossible for me or for many observers really to know. I mean, nobody has a clear idea of exactly how many rockets Hezbollah has or where they are exactly. I think, if anything, people have been surprised by the capacity of some of the weapons that Hezbollah has been using, and in Nasrallah's speeches, he's been promising surprises and so on. Some of that could just be bluster, but then again, it's hard to say what sort of military capacity they have at that point.
We heard Ehud Olmert saying to Parliament, the Knesset, yesterday, they're going to go after every terrorist infrastructure in every location. What would that require? Give us a sense of how widespread the infrastructure of Hezbollah military strength in Lebanon is.
Well, it's complicated because they are really spread out in the south. Effectively, the Hezbollah military wing does control the area, you could even say south of Beirut. They do control a lot of south Lebanon. But you also have to keep in mind that Hezbollah is also a very popular political organization in this country. They have representatives in government. They have members in parliament. They have social services, hospitals, schools, and so on that provide services to a lot of Lebanese Shiites mainly. And, sort of uprooting and taking the infrastructure of this organization out is a lot more complicated than just confronting their military wing.
Israel says it wants Lebanon to follow through on the UN agreement that came with Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon. It wants the Lebanese army, not Hezbollah, on the southern border of Lebanon. Is the government in any position to do that? Can you see a path by which they might become in a position to do that?
There isn't really. They don't really have the will at this point or the ability to confront Hezbollah. Again, Hezbollah are members of the government, so they would effectively be turning on themselves within the government. And the Lebanese army, the conventional wisdom is they're really not an effective enough force to confront Hezbollah, nor would the government maybe decide to turn the army on Hezbollah and confront them to force them to disarm. So this is part of the very complicated, part of the complicated problems that are leading to this crisis is that there's definitely no easy way out, no easy options, and no choices that are easy for the Lebanese government to take.
Kofi Annan and Tony Blair talking about getting international forces in there to calm things down. Are Lebanese anticipating that? What do they think is coming next here?
Well, there is a UN force that is here on the ground, UNIFIL, and they've been here, for many years. And one idea, a few of the Lebanese parliamentarians that I've talked to said that one idea is to beef up this force and, deploy them in a wider range of areas along the border and for them to oversee, maybe a pullback of Hezbollah from the border a bit more. But again, there's nothing concrete at this stage. This is just one of, I think, several ideas being discussed.
Okay. Describe to us the damage to Lebanon's national infrastructure at this point. Is this, equivalent to a bad storm or something worse?
It's been pretty extensive. I mean, you can say that a lot of the major roads and bridges have taken hits. The southern suburbs of Beirut, where Hezbollah had their offices, have been really demolished. I mean, they've been flattened in many ways and repeatedly bombed. So the damage to the infrastructure is heavy, but also when you do talk to the Lebanese people, what they see is really the far-reaching economic impact of this. The faith that they had worked so hard to build up among tourists, the services industries, these are their specialties. These are the things that they've been trying to build up in the past decade and more. And now that this has happened, what they see is just a economic loss that's going to carry on for many, many years.
And a death toll to boot. Babak Daganpache, Middle East correspondent for Newsweek in Beirut. Babak, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to turn now to Jerusalem. We're joined by Joel Greenberg, correspondent in Jerusalem for the Chicago Tribune. Joel, thanks for being with us. What's the mood in Israel today as this fighting goes on?
Hello. Well, the situation here is that the government is talking about moving into a diplomatic mode. The foreign minister here, Tzipi Livni, just spoke a brief while ago in a news conference and said that diplomacy time has come and that Israel is going to try to push in tandem with the military operation in Lebanon, a diplomatic effort to secure the goals that it wants, namely pushing Hezbollah back from the border with Israel and the return of two soldiers that were taken by Hezbollah.
That seems like almost in conflict with Ehud Olmert's comments yesterday that they'll track down every terrorist everywhere, root out all the infrastructure. That has not happened diplomatically. Is Israel going to really support, for example, Kofi Annan's idea of a stabilization force in Lebanon?
Well, I think in the short term, the military, the army here, still wants to, obviously, as any army does, pursue all its objectives and keep going. And I think they do have a green light right now from the government to continue their operations, their offensive in Lebanon. But at the same time, international diplomacy is picking up steam, and Israel has to face the fact that the international community is getting involved. There are UN envoys here who are meeting with Israeli officials, and I think Israel needs to respond. It feels that it needs to respond to that diplomatic effort. So I think that's why we're hearing these comments from the foreign minister today.
Israel's deputy chief of staff saying yesterday that there may be large numbers of ground forces not ruled out in Lebanon, that the offensive in Lebanon could go on for another few weeks. What about the impact on Israel of the missiles coming across from Hezbollah? What's the death toll? How far have they reached?
Well, I just returned from Haifa, which is the northern port city. It's the third largest city in Israel, and it's been hit by rockets again today. I was there at about noon or about 1 o'clock when the sirens went off, and everybody went in to take cover. And people are really living between the bomb shelters and their apartments. And when the sirens go off, they go down for a few minutes and wait to hear the impact and hope it's not in their neighborhood. So definitely in terms of northern Israel, people are still feeling they feel under attack. And the number of dead in Israel is about a dozen civilians overall. There have been rockets fired over the whole period, really hundreds according to the Army's count, into a whole range of communities along northern Israel, but deeper than before. Haifa is about 20 miles from the Lebanese border, and it has not been targeted in rocket attacks from Lebanon before.
Joel, do you feel or hear a sense of relief from Israelis that Hezbollah is being confronted here, or fear of where this conflict, this fighting may go?
Well, I just talking to people in Haifa, even people as they sit in the shelters or in their houses nervously, there's generally a lot of support for this military action. Almost everyone that I've spoken to supported it, said it was time to deal with Hezbollah. Hezbollah posed a threat that was building along Israel's northern border with its missiles, and that they're willing to put up with this rocket barrage in order for the army to do the job, as that's the way they put it.
Joel, thanks for being with us. We've got some great voices, observers that will be joining us in this hour. I want to turn first to San Diego, California, and Vali Nasser. He's professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Shia Revival, has a piece in the current issue of Foreign Affairs titled When the Shiites Rise. Vali Nasser, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be there. Thank you.
So we're trying to get a sense of the dimensions of this conflict now. Ehud Olmert pointing straight at Damascus and Tehran, Syria and Iran in his speech yesterday. Has something changed? Has the ground in this conflict changed with this open fighting between Hezbollah and Israel?
Well, yeah, to some extent it has. First of all, even into so far as Hezbollah is championing the Palestinian cause, we're seeing the two major Shia forces in the region, Iran and Hezbollah, taking the lead, trying to force a change, a paradigm change, in the way in which the Arab-Israeli issue is being dealt with. Iran has been trying to even put to question Israel's existence, and Hezbollah is trying to go back to the pre-Oslo ways of attacking Israel militarily and trying to confront it. And the traditional powerhouses in the region are sort of sidelined in this conflict. That's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan. They don't have any pawns in this game, and they have been rather marginalized. So in many ways, the kind of conflict that emerged in Iraq between the Shiites and Sunnis, with Iran playing a far major role, has now been spreading further north in the region, in the Levant as well.
Do you see the conflict spreading beyond Lebanon, or do you believe it will be contained there? There are harsh words toward Damascus and Tehran. Could Israel end up hitting either Syria or Iran in this round of fighting?
Well, it is possible. Israel has been talking tough, although escalation beyond the Lebanese scene will also be costly and unpredictable for Israel. But I think on the other side, as far as the Iranians are concerned, they are not interested in a broader conflict. Their interest has been to assert their regional role, to try to make sure that the U.S. understands that Iran is a big regional player and has to be engaged if there's to be security in the region, and they also want to appeal to the Arab street as a champion of the Palestinian cause ahead of what they see a confrontation with the U.S. and the United Nations over the nuclear issue.
What about the Arab street and the implications for moderate regimes, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia lumped in there as well? Are there implications for these regimes as the Arab street, as you put it, looks on and watches what's happening in Lebanon?
Well, that's always been the case. Governments that are close to Washington feel themselves under pressure when their populations are not happy with American or Israeli policy and show a visceral anti-Israeli, anti-American reaction to developments on the ground. It puts them in a precarious position. And the Iranians have been calculating, pursuant to the positive reception that Ahmadinejad got after his attacks on Israel and Holocaust, verbal attacks on Israel and Holocaust, that the Arab street is likely to champion or to support and react positively to the Iranian and Hezbollah politics. Now, whether that ends up actually being the case is a gamble that I think the Iranians have been willing to take.
Is there a possibility of instability in Jordan, in Egypt? Is the emotion in the street, support for Hezbollah, strong enough to actually threaten any of these governments?
Well, I don't think in the short run. I think these governments are very well endowed in security terms to be able to contain their populations, and there have not been signs of street demonstrations yet. That might change if Israel, for instance, attacks Syria. What happens in the region is that the cost of governments, the cost to any government in order to have support of its people will rise. In other words, the governments in Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia are going to feel increasingly pressure from an unhappy population, and that has its own internal calculus in those countries.
Vali Nasser in San Diego, please stand by for a moment if you would. I want to welcome two more voices into our conversation. First, from London, we're joined by Shai Feldman. He's director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. He was head of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, 97 to 2005. Shai Feldman, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And with me in the studio, Richard Norton, professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University, author of numerous books, including Amal and the Shia. He's been studying Hezbollah for more than 20 years. Richard Norton, thank you for being here.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Shai Feldman, first to you, if I could. You've described Israel's actions in the last week as equivalent to the U.S. Hitting back after the 9/11 attacks. What's going on here?
Well, I think that what is not really sufficiently appreciated is what is at stake for the Israeli government, and particularly the government headed by Ehud Olmert. This government has essentially organized around one principle, which is to continue Israel's disengagement from the Palestinians, what began last summer in Gaza, to continue that in the West Bank. And the problem is that everything that has happened since Israel's disengagement from Gaza, and then now accelerated with the attack by Hezbollah, the kidnapping of the soldiers, and then the ambush of the tank, and so on, created a chain reaction, which threatens the main goal and the main purpose of Israel's government, which, as I said, is to disengage from the West Bank. And the reason is that the perception that the Israeli population has now is that Israel disengaged from Gaza, and with all the Qassam rocket attacks and so on after Israel's disengagement, it found Gaza chasing after it. And with the Hezbollah attacks, it felt Israel withdrew from Lebanon in May 2000, and now Lebanon is coming chasing after it. And this, of course, complicates tremendously public support for continuing this process in the West Bank, because the notion is that if this is the case, if every time Israel disengages, it finds the problem chasing after it, the problem, of course, if this is implemented in the West Bank, is a much more complicated issue because of the proximity of the West Bank to Israel's large metropolitan areas and to other strategic locations like Ben Gurion International Airport. If you had the same Qassam rocket attacks launched from the West Bank against Israel, not a single plane would be able to land or take off in Ben Gurion International Airport.
Shai Feldman, let me ask you then: Is this
the public support for the very principle around which the new Israeli government is organized, and hence the broader context of this particular conflict with this particular chain reaction with Lebanon, and that's why there's so much at stake here.
There is a sense, Shai Feldman, that this is a kind of clear the decks, let's deal with all of this moment for Israel, both in the rhetoric and in the ferocity of the attacks in Lebanon. Are you saying the Oslo format is dead, as Vali Nasser is, that disengagement is dead? Is Israel now, in a sense, going eyeball to eyeball with Iran?
Well, I don't think disengagement is dead, because for one simple reason, which is that disengagement is meant to be able to restore Israel's character as a Jewish and democratic state. It wasn't meant to necessarily to improve Israel's security, but at the same time, it's also absolutely clear that there is a threshold of security risks that Israel can take in order to fulfill that goal. And unless it finds a way to restore its deterrence, and clearly the Qassam rocket attacks against Israel from Gaza and the attacks by Hezbollah has been a major challenge to Israeli deterrence.
Can it restore deterrence without addressing the Iranian allies of the Hezbollah?
Well, here is the problem. The problem is that one wants to somehow strike the right balance between the imperative of restoring deterrence without escalating and broadening this conflict, especially horizontally to countries like Syria and Iran. And so you will also see that the rhetoric is also balanced. Ehud Olmert's very strong speech of yesterday is balanced today by a much more measured speech by Israel's foreign minister, which emphasizes now the role of diplomacy. So you'll see some acrobatics here in the next few days, which result from the fact that there are competing pressures and competing interests that Israel faces simultaneously as this crisis unfolds.
Shai Feldman in London, please stand by. Richard Norton with me here in the studio. You've written, Israel is now striving to turn parts of southern Lebanon into a largely depopulated killing box where Hezbollah and its capability can be methodically whittled away. How far do you see this conflict going? Can Israel actually whittle away that Hezbollah strength that we're told is sort of ensconced house by house, cave by cave in Lebanon?
Well, Tom, South Lebanon is very difficult territory. I walked many of the wadis and hills of South Lebanon, and I can tell you that without having soldiers on the ground, it's very difficult to imagine the kind of defeat of Hezbollah that Ehud Olmert has talked about. But, of course, it's a question of time, and it's a matter of how much time the Israelis are going to be allowed to continue this really over-the-top, excessive assault on Lebanon. They may be given a week or so. If they are, then we're going to see a significant degradation, of course, in the capabilities of Hezbollah. But I think Hezbollah is probably going to survive as a significant factor in Lebanese politics and probably as a militia. It's instructive that in the war of resistance, which Hezbollah fought against Israel, which occupied southern Lebanon effectively for 22 years, the full-time cadre of Hezbollah was only 450-500 people.
And now?
And now it's maybe 700 or 800. But the point is that it depends on broad-based popular support. In effect, it was a big reserve system, and it was able to call on the Shi'i community for lots of support. And that support is still very much there. People give Hezbollah great credit for forcing the Israelis to decide to withdraw from Lebanon in May of 2000.
You've also written that the Israeli military has been chomping at the bit to sort of settle scores with Hezbollah for a long time. And you're saying that Israel's offensive in Lebanon is likely intended to make it easier to move against Iran. Are you describing that as imminent, as eventual, as inevitable? Or how do you see it?
Well, I must say I disagree with Shai a bit. I don't think this is simply about the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is about the Israeli military having the capacity, without having to face a barrage of rockets from South Lebanon, to strike at Iran. And there clearly is a willingness to think about attacking Iran and its nuclear facilities.
So you empty the killing box, as you call it, of the 10 or 13,000 missiles, there as many as you can, and then less threat on your border so you can move
afar.
That's
right. It improves your options. There's a deep strategy here that extends well beyond disengagement, which is increasingly being contested within Israel, if you read the public opinion polls. There's a deep strategy here, and it extends well beyond the Arab-Israeli zone to Iran. This is about Israeli hegemony and Israeli freedom of action. And there's no question that the generals have been frustrated by the successes of Hezbollah over the years. And Hezbollah gave them a very fine excuse with the operation of 12 July to launch this operation, which is precisely intended to improve Israeli options in this deeper strategy.
Vali Nasser in San Diego, are we indeed stepping out of the parameters that this conflict has lived in for such a long time and into a new world here?
Well, yes, I think Dick is correct in the sense that for a while now, it seems that what you have is that the two real powers in the Middle East facing each other off are increasingly Israel and Iran. And the issue of Iran's nuclear capability is really about whether the balance of power between these two countries. And given that one of Iran's strongest allies and most important assets is Hezbollah in Lebanon, it potentially would have been inevitable that perhaps the battle between the two of them would have been engaged there first. And in many ways, the Iranians are testing the Israeli resolve and capability, both tactically as well as strategically. And Israel, in some ways, probably feels compelled to send a very, very strong signal to Iran that it is willing to take a tough stand and go it all the way. And I think in the next week or so that Dick is talking about is a question of how each of these powers sees its next move being interpreted by the West, other regional powers, and particularly by their adversary, whether it's seen as a sign of weakness or a sign of strength, and then they calibrate how they're going to react to it.
Let me take a call from Nora in Barrington, Rhode Island. Hi, Nora, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to express my opinion. I survived 15 years of war in Lebanon, and I've been in the U.S. since 1989. And I'm very saddened to see what happens over and over and over again in my country. The reason, what I see basically is that Lebanon is becoming the eye of the storm for regional and international conflicts. And we see it repeated year after year for the past, 45 years?
Maybe? Nora, Israel says Lebanon needs to clean up the southern border. We cannot live with this threat of thousands of missiles right across the border. Why hasn't Lebanon done that? I mean, the images are terrible. The death is terrible.
Lebanon is a hostage. They killed these people who are doing the same mess for Israel, have killed many of the Lebanese deputies. They killed also many important people in the parliament. People are afraid.
And we feel that pain. We see that suffering right there. There's no question about it. Shai Feldman, do you see the risk of a broader regional war here?
Well, I don't. There's always a risk of, as I said, of this getting escalated, broadening horizontally. I don't think it's in Israel's interest. I think that talks of killing fields and so on, I think is really quite beside the point. The fact of the matter is that there was a sense of a stable, if you wish, balance of terror along the two sides of the Israeli-Lebanese border.
Matthew's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what exactly did Hezbollah want in return for the two soldiers, and what would have been the cost to Israel to agree to those demands?
Let us pick it up. Richard Norton, you're our Hezbollah man here today. What do you think was the agenda? And as you answer that, what about also the talk that Iran ordered this kidnapping because it wanted to divert attention from nukes? Give us the whole captive picture here.
Thank you, Tom. On the last point, that this was part of a grand plot or a grand strategy involving Iran and Hezbollah, frankly, I don't buy it. I think what's at stake here, or what is happening, is developing from a massive miscalculation on the part of Nasrallah. The Israelis and Hezbollah, as Shai Feldman indicated, had a kind of rule book. They understood the rules of the game. Civilians were not to be struck. Incursions, when they took place, were generally in the occupied Golan Heights and so on. In general, there was a kind of Marcus of Queensberry set of rules that both sides observed. I'm convinced that Nasrallah, looking at Israeli operations in Gaza and believing in his ability to deter Israel with his arsenal of rockets, thought that he could carry out this operation on 12 July and frankly get away with it.
And that he would actually get the release of Palestinian prisoners, which is what they've asked for.
Well, Palestinian and particularly Lebanese prisoners. Mm-hmm. There are about three Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails who've been
held.
Three? Three only, yes. One of them is responsible for a terrorist incident in Nahariya in 1979. One is simply a fisherman. I don't remember the details of the other. Most of the Lebanese prisoners were released in a swap that was negotiated by the Germans in January 2004.
The request off the Gaza Israeli soldier prisoner was much bigger. Thousands of Palestinians. So you're saying you believe Nasrallah, Hezbollah, literally just wanted the release
of
three prisoners.
It's not just that, Tom. They wanted to sort of bolster their standing in the Arab world as proponents of Palestinian rights and so on. And Nasrallah, since 2000 in particular, has really been a kind of rock star in Arab popular culture. He's charismatic. He's analytically sharp. He's
Will the very destruction
impressive.
Of Lebanon make him more or less popular?
Well, I think he sacrificed a significant part of his base with this miscalculation, because Hezbollah had seen a broadening political base as it developed into a political party. And I think a lot of that base, which is middle class and frankly has no particular interest in these kinds of horrible adventures, are going to basically be lost to Hezbollah now. So I think we're probably likely to see a significant shrinkage of the party's popularity.
Shai Feldman, do you see any chance that Israel will simply respond to the demand for the release of prisoners here, let three go and see if they can end this?
Well, I disagree with the statement that the Israeli ambassador made. I don't believe that what will happen here is that there's any chance for Hezbollah first releasing the captured soldiers, and then we'll see a deal. The release of the captured soldiers will only be part of a deal, of a comprehensive deal. And I think on that score, Ehud Olmert's speech was quite realistic. He didn't talk about the disarmament of Hezbollah because that would have posed an unrealistic objective. He simply talked about the release of these soldiers, stopping the missile barrage, and essentially the Lebanese army asserting control over the south of Lebanon.
But he did say that Israel would go after the infrastructure of terrorism everywhere.
Well, as I said in response to a previous question, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric right now. Yesterday, his rhetoric was quite extreme. Today, you see it in the foreign minister talk or conversation, a more measured response. As she says, now is the role for diplomacy. Well, that clearly goes against this notion that, you know, we will fight them on the beaches and, you know, and so on. So I think that yes, the military will push to as long as Israel finds itself in this confrontation, to try to reduce the Hezbollah's rocket force as much as one can. But I think on the other hand, there are serious cross pressures. There is serious interest in preventing further escalation of this, and hence I think the role of diplomacy. And I think the real key question here now, since everybody recognizes that the Lebanese army is not yet suited to reassert control over the south, what kind of international force can one interject there in the interim until the Lebanese army is ready to assume, essentially to assert Lebanon's sovereignty over the entire country?
If they could do that, let's turn to Annapolis, Maryland, and Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if your guests would comment on my thoughts that it is actually in the interest of both Iran and Israel to make this a broader regional conflict. Iran may be behind Hezbollah's initiating these actions for some of the reasons your guests spoke about, including its regional power. And it also takes the heat off them, at least initially, from continued UN Security Council pressure. And is Israel, quite the opposite, would like that pressure to become more robust and more immediate on Iran, and therefore making this a broader regional conflict between Israel and Iran tends, I think, to be in both of their interests.
Mike, I see a note here that you teach at the Naval Academy. Do you think that's where it's headed?
I'm afraid I do.
Vali Nasser, there's the regional issue again, and whether it may be, in a way, in the interest of both Israel and Iran to sort of take the bring-it-on strategy here. What do you say to that? And also, what about Richard Norton's contention that this would not have been ordered by Iran? This would be Hezbollah in Lebanon itself deciding to move.
Well, on whether or not it would benefit Israel, I would let Shai answer that. But I think Iran would not want a broad regional conflict. It is costly and unpredictable, and it can actually backfire. What they want is a policy of essentially a controlled degree of conflict, enough to be able to position themselves. And I think Iran's main interest in this, and, you know, we can guess as to the degree of their involvement in having planned and supported Hezbollah. But I think Iran's interest is really to put pressure on the United States by trying to broaden the scope of conflicts in the Middle East, where the U.S. has an interest and where Iran is a party. And many Iranian officials have said on and off in varieties of ways that the U.S. does not really take Iran seriously and does not understand how important Iran is in every arena, from Afghanistan to Persian Gulf to Iraq to Lebanon. And if there is going to be stability in this region, the U.S. has to engage Iran. So So Iran does not want an outright conflict. It rather wants to bring the point home to the U.S. And I think all along, when Ahmadinejad attacked the Holocaust, when he began his rhetoric against Israel, you know, there was a lot of talk that this is going to backfire, and one might say the same things about Hezbollah's calculus. But I think the Iranians, at least, and possibly the Hezbollah as well, are looking at this and calculating in terms of political rewards in a very different way than one we would have thought, that they're really gambling that in the long run, even the military cost, even though they may be downsized militarily by Israeli attacks, that they will get a stronger regional position.
And is that long run to do with the demise of Israel? Is that still literally on their agenda?
I think at least as far as the Iranians are concerned, the issue of Israeli power is partly ideological, but it's partly realpolitik. I mean, the Iranians don't consider the Arab countries around them really as a threat to Iran's claim to be a hegemon in the region, but they do believe Israel's military power and political capability is really the only force that they have to consider. Iran sees itself as a regional hegemon, and its gamble in all of these conflicts has to do with asserting that position.
And yet, you can't help wonder if all these gambles could turn into a spiral right out of people's control. Let's turn to Arlington, Virginia, and Marianne. Hi, Marianne. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm finding this whole situation to just be so upsetting for a variety of reasons. I called in reaction to statement that, you know, the continued escalation may preclude the engagement of the moderate Islam and Arabic nations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to have the expert make me feel a little bit more sanguine. My problem is that I don't see any political moderates in any decision-making positions, number one. And number two, I have yet to hear the articulation of any statement of compromise that is not extreme, such as the removal of the State of Israel, the one that is not recognized. And I would love to know, where are we headed? Where is my position of hope, according to the expert?
Looking for some moderation here. Richard Norton, pick this up with us. Marianne says, who's going to carry that flame? Does anybody really want to? I would just reference here George Will writing today, raising the same question about Bush administration policy and saying that, the Bush administration sometimes seems to see violence at itself as vindication, instability, no matter how pandemic or lethal, necessarily as a sign of progress. George Will writes. So where is moderation here, to Marianne's question, or are we fundamentally on a path that leads toward greater conflict?
Well, Tom, this is a horrible time in the Middle East. The situation is very polarized. The occupation of Iraq has had a significant role in that. It's a time of heightened sectarianism. It's a time when U.S. diplomatic tools are very limited, and we have no dialogue with Iran. Virtually any serious expert you talk to in Washington would tell you we need to have a dialogue with Iran. We have a president who calls for restraint in this horrible war, and yet on Friday of last week, the U.S. approved the sale of over $200 million worth of JP-8, which is jet fuel, which means that the U.S. is literally going to be fueling the planes that are bombing Lebanon while we are calling for restraint. So, you know, restraint starts at home, and we need to have a much more engaged diplomacy than we have. This cowboy diplomacy, as we've learned to our pain already, is not taking us very far in Iraq or elsewhere.
But we want to have a sense, or Marianne does, let's say, that somebody here is really pushing for some kind of moderation, that it's, or are we being driven by views that actually welcome a kind of bring it on regionally, let's have this out once and for all, or is that just over the top fear?
Well, I mean, the question is, can we hear moderation when it is actually offered? For example, with some great effort, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, oversaw the negotiation of the acceptance by Hamas by Palestinian nationalists associated with Fatah and other organizations, a so-called prisoners' agreement, which had, from the Israel standpoint, unacceptable elements, but nonetheless...
This is the prisoners saying, let's talk about recognizing Israel.
And let's basically premise our discussions on a state, living with a state solution. And, you know, the answer is that we have instead a terrible assault on Gaza. I condemn the kidnapping of Israeli soldiers. I don't think this helps anything at all. But what we have in this case is an Israeli government that is unable to pick up the thread of really a significant possible initiative and instead only understands the logic of force and domination. So force is a problem, and restraint is much needed. And restraint begins at home, not just in the Arab capitals.
But at a lot of homes. Shai Feldman, you may see that differently, but I'm sure you do. But do you see, do you fear an inexorable quality to this conflict? You say Israel wants to turn to, or at least introduce a diplomatic note here as well. Could this get away from everybody and turn into a bigger regional conflict despite intentions of moderation?
Well, we've come to that question from different directions more than once.
Yes, we have.
And my answer remains the same. Yes, it can get out of hand, but I don't think that Israel has any interest in this. I think that if you look at if you ask yourself, what have been the basic purposes of the Israeli government? Nothing in what is happening now in front of us is consistent with anything that this new government was meant to achieve. It was meant to achieve a continuation of Israel's disengagement from the Palestinians. It was meant to achieve a continuous prosperity of the Israeli economy. And so the idea that right now Israel has some kind of a calculation in which it seeks a confrontation, a broader confrontation, a confrontation with Iran, a confrontation around the Middle East. I mean, I find this rather preposterous. I just don't recognize this in anything that either the vast majority of Israelis or the vast majority of the members of the Israeli government are seeking. And the issue of Israeli activity versus Gaza has a much broader context than the two Israeli soldiers that were taken captive. It has everything to do with the fact that attacks against Israel continued after Israel's disengagement. And anyone that criticizes Israeli reaction to these attacks should suggest what exact alternative strategy did Israel have in responding to the situation. And as I mentioned, in this issue, there are broader matters at stake. It is not just the issue of the security and safety of Israeli citizens residing inside Israel in areas close to the Gaza Strip.
I'm afraid that's as far as we're going to get to take it today. Shai Feldman, thank you very much for joining us. Richard Norton at Boston University of Ali Nasser in San Diego today. Thanks to each of you for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.